Hello and welcome to recording number 36 of Gary Gygax's and Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 16th, 2021. I'm going to start a little earlier, move up two paragraphs. I'm also going to give a little summary here because this is quite a... I found this quite so interesting a battle going on here, and no mention of Gord yet, that I really even lost track of time yesterday, and so had just ended it kind of on the fly. Right, what was happening is a very large contingent, I would think somewhere around 20,000 or more men, of the an army of Ivid, the Overking of the Great Kingdom, is marching through the Adri Forest, and he is hoping to ambush the forces of King Archibald of Nyrond, and he's got another trapping force, two others, humanoids from the Bone March, and also Grenel. Who's called the Jackal, who's moving down his vile troops down upon them from, I believe, the northeast and down north from the humanoids, hoping to trap and annihilate the unsuspecting army of Archibald, King of Nyrond. Now, the woods folk have found out about all this, and they are moving in a force. They've gathered up a force of several thousand, at least 6,000 of the woods folk. And it was mentioned that the rivers folk would actually be participating in this battle, but it wasn't mentioned what size force they had. And so what they've done is there was a large force moving ahead in the van of the army, moving up this road and acting as a scouting force. And they moved ahead a little bit by several miles, and the woods and river folk were able to set up an ambush just as these scouts were crossing the wide ford here at a place called Woodsford. All right. As this force moving forward of evil woodsmen, bandits, and mercenaries cross the ford, they are struck by the archers of the woods folk, the good woods folk. And they're being cut down and forced to retreat. And as they're retreating, the druids summon insect spell right in the midst of where their leader, Lord Lomor, was when crossing the ford, and stopping everything except trying to get rid of these insects. And a lot and by the time that their last magic user was able to dispel the summon insects, it was too late, and the archers and river folk cut down Lomar's force to the last man. And then they clean up the area, and they leave it for the approaching main body. And the main body notices that they've taken some of the horses and taken some of the uniforms, and they're hoping to do the same thing to the main body's force. And the main body starts off with these mounted archers and these Imperial Guard who are, pole arm men, and then it's going to be a big force of the men of the guard of the Overking. And these are very well armored men. So as they approach, they get caught up a little earlier, but in the ambush, and they're stuck in the middle of the ford. And we were just describing how in the last couple paragraphs the description is that the pole armed men are moving forward, and they're going to fight their way through to the the west bank of the shallow ford, and then hopefully slaughter the more lightly armed archers. So I'm going to start here. You will have some of this on the previous recording, because I really want to provide context. It has been an excellent excellent description of the fight so far. I'm thrown off a little here by pages. Let me get to the right page. It is 270. All right, and it is just paragraph 2 I'm starting at, so we're jumping back a little to what had gone on in the previous recording. The disciplined sacrifice of the archers was not in vain, for coming at the double was the narrow column of pole-armed infantry. When their bristling mass of glaives and falchards crossed the ford and struck into the lightly protected archers on the far shore, the sharp edges and points would pierce the woodsman's line and spread out along the river edge. Thus the onslaught of flying shafts would be assuaged, and the cruel tormentors plying their deadly bows would be slain. Although arrows rained in arching fire over the heads of the screening shortbowmen and crossbowmen to fall upon the rushing brigade of infantry, these latter men were more heavily armored, with studded jacks of padded leather over chainmail, and their front ranks were provided with steel chest plates and greaves as well. A few fell, but most came on unharmed. The screen of bowmen before them parted at their coming, glad at their comrades' ferocity and lusting for the slaughter of their arrival pretended. This parting enabled the woodsmen to increase the effect of their archery upon the infantry, however. And the whole ranks of the pole-armed Imperials dropped before a new onslaught of arrows. Still, those behind came grimly on, lowering their weapons as they filled the front of the column, stepping over the fallen in their path. Had the water not slowed their advance, far fewer would have been killed. This was not the case. Finally, the ford was crossed by the leading men of the column, but their rush fell onto empty ground, for the woodsmen had fallen back before the Imperial charge. 100 yards away, a company of bowmen continued to stand across the open road, loosing missiles steadily at their foemen, while from the flanking woods came still more shafts. As the full force of the pole-armed brigade came on to firm ground, its parts were sent left, right, and ahead to clear the trees of snipers. In such conditions, though, shorted axe, morning star, and sword are as good as, or even better, than the long-handled weapons the Imperials carried. A raging melee swirled through the trees as that part of the woodsfolk contingent, without missile weapons, no longer had to stand and watch their fellows work. They fell to with joy at this point, at the defending force had suffered losses numbering only a few hundred, while the invading army sent in the Adri by the Overking had lost thousands. The foresters' hearts were singing, and their hopes were high. Break. Here we have the continued battle. I guess I'm wondering where the few hundred fell so far. Perhaps in the there was some melee in the original fight as well. Now they're talking about, they've already now slain several thousand of these in the Overking's army. Now we know that initial force was only 1,000, so they've caused there are three of these groupings of small bowmen, and then crossbowmen, and then these pole-armed foes, which kind of says that those first two groups must have been pretty annihilated for several thousand of these men to be killed. We have, you know, this was kind of something I had expected, that the archers withdrew before the pole-armed troops had entered the woods. But I kind of disagree that just saying that in the melee in the woods, these men that are falling upon them with handheld weapons, you know, rather than pole arms, except for the roadway, they should be at a huge advantage rather than an equal, because those pole arms, especially these, Fouchered forks might be okay, but they're not the best kind of thing to be trying to wield in a thick wood. The length of the weapon is not going to be effective against a foe that they're not going up directly. That's hiding behind trees and coming at them, and you know, using that as cover. And not being able to be shoulder to shoulder to fight in formation, I would say that they'd be at a monstrous disadvantage as pole-armed troops. And from the description, these are men that they have wonderful armor for normal troops that are in pole arms. I'd initially thought that they all had steel chest plates, but it mentions that that is only the front ranks had the steel chest plates and greaves. So they had, you know, a definite formation of them. Perhaps the very outer line of troops in this pole-arm formation had this armor. All right. Now I'm going to... I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 271, paragraph 3. After serving as the hard place against which the nut of the vanguard of the Imperial Army had been wiped out, Gord's unit had recrossed the Harp and rejoined the others. They had not suffered more than a dozen casualties, thanks to Curly Greenleaf's use of spells and their own hard fighting. They were then sent off to a place on the left flank where they were hidden and kept ready to reinforce either those who held the bank before them or the center, where the hardest blow was sure to fall. From his unit's hiding place, Gord was unable to see any of the initial fighting against the main force, but word came that the hated Imperial archers and crossbowmen had been cut down by fully two-thirds, and that the brigade of infantry that followed was being mauled by the savage woodsmen. The sounds of the battle were coming closer. Break. So I think that what these melee troops are, probably are the barbarians, and that within, you know, the AD&D game is an actual character class. So I would assume that most of these woods folk are either regular fighters, but with certain abilities and practices that make them very ranger like unclassed NPCs who have some advantage, with bowmanship, and finally probably rangers themselves. We already know that the druids of this land have gathered together to fight this army. Just to remind everybody, Curly Greenleaf is a 10th level druid, which in AD&D is a very, very high level. All right. I'm going to restart on page 271. I'm ready to trash some of those libertines, Church said nervously, flipping his great axe. Let's have a contest, you and me, said Wren. The one who knocks over the most of those blueback sissies gets the other a servant for the evening. Their banter was interrupted by the voice of a captain who was calling the group into a rough line. Stalker's band went on to the far right. Archers in the front rank, Frank and others behind, both Gord and his hulking friend were thus at the forefront, for Wren was impressed with the aim Gord had displayed. While slinging missiles at the Iridians' hired soldiery hours earlier, Curly Greenleaf was off somewhere else, probably with the commanders of this unit, Gord theorized, for he now realized just how powerful spellcasters of any nature could be, and druids in particular. He made a mental note to avoid finding out what it was like to be on the wrong end of some hostile spellbinder's pointing finger. Break. And Gygax, Gord has now gained several levels, and he really has not had much encounter anywhere so far with spellcasters. Now, Gygax had always impressed that, you know, the spellcasters were extremely rare. You know, rarer than fighters and thieves. And, you know, generally, you didn't encounter them casually. And here he's, you know, reiterating that again, because Gord, as has been shown in this writing, has not come across many of these magic users before.
I wonder what level Gord actually is right now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, I'm not quite sure. We may find out there is a description at the very back of the book after this story has ended that explains some things. But I'm actually rereading this because I've read it before. I'm discovering things, and it's been several years, and I've really forgotten most of this story. So I think in reading it, I never really looked all that closely at the story itself.
Yeah, because it's easy when reading just to plod through it and not necessarily pay full attention. But now we have a chance to really do a good study of it.
Yeah, I think I'm weakest on talking about the story itself. And I know that is like the focus of a lot of the reviews. And I will say, I had come down very heavily after my last reading, which was several years ago. And I was being very critical, vocally, people I met, other Greyhawkers online and stuff, that I didn't care for the story. But like this little battle scene has been wonderful. And in general, the story itself is not too bad. I don't think it's great fiction, but I don't think it is bad fiction.
I always thought it was a lot better than it got credit for. But you're right. Yes. It's not great. It's not Tolkien, but I mean, it does fantasy well, it does thieves well, and it's set in Greyhawk. So, I mean, it's great for me.
Yeah, and I think it does, it's from a thief's point of view, which, and a thief that started off in a terrible circumstance. And I think Gygax has done a very admirable job. The more that I, the way he's put it together and everything, that it has been exciting as a story. I don't think it's been, it's had some clunky dialogue that was a little too 20th century for me, like, 20th century gangster kind of talk.
Yeah, I think we just got a little bit of it not too long ago in the last bit you read.
And what's has been happening is that some of that has faded off for more fantasy and medieval kind of talk. But that's just a little bit of clunkiness. It's not, I think, done without thought. I just think that Gygax in certain sections definitely wanted to have what he said understood.
I think he's doing a good job with the fantasy novel in the context of the game. He's trying to make it true to the game, and I think he's doing pretty well.
Yeah, and it's very meaty right now because even though Gord's getting higher level, he's still in the mid-level range, where a lot of there's more abilities and strength. But there's not so much that he's like a superhero or anything. He was a little James Bondish back in Stoink. He's supposed to still be young. He's got this naivete among women. And it's just part of his character. We haven't seen, now we have Ren, but Gygax, doesn't seem to be particularly good with women, but that is a common occurrence even among, people who are described as the best writers there ever were. They weren't necessarily good at, really describing women in their stories or the women's actions and stuff. So anyway, we have Ren now, who is a gigantic. Chert is described as huge, and I believe she's described as bigger than Chert. And Gord, of course, is very small. It is very Fairford and Mauser. He might have done better not to encourage that comparison, with Gord and Chert to Fairford and Mauser. But it was... The Lieber stuff was a big influence on Gygax.
It's great stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's kind of what I'm slip on from time to time here, is not really going through it about what's happening in the story or happening in the characters and examining the characters, because Gord is an NPC within the Gygax setting, and he is really, because he's the focus of seven books, he is very well described. So if you want to use him and these other people as NPCs in your own campaign, especially because Gord, this is a story from Gord at 12 years old and untrained to Gord progressing in training, so he is a very encounterable character, now and before. He does move through Greyhawk, and he is in the other places, but for a short time. Like Stoink gets a lot of description, but Gord is there for a relatively short time before he escapes with Evely, and then is an unwelcome character back in Stoink. And, I'll say here, we're introduced to a number. We got introduced to Geller and Stoink, and he's become a very important character. Now we meet Curly Greenleaf and Chert. We're seeing some more prominent NPC characters. We got introduced to poor Lord Lomar, who's only in it for a few pages before he's,
here for a minute.
Yeah, and then he's gone.
Well, we did get to see the woodsman holding his standard. That was his swan song, I guess.
Yeah, and his body fallen in the ford there, before he can even make the other bank for his retreat. All right. Let me restart here. And we are on page 272, second paragraph. The sounds of fighting were closer than ever now, and whistles alerted the awaiting woodsfolk to be ready. Arrows were knocked, and Gord placed one of his stones in his sling. Almost without warning, a knot of men burst into their view. Imperial troops with wicked-looking falchioned forks chivying several defenders whose shorter weapons were unable to score damage on the advancing men-at-arms. Gord loosed the stone from his sling just as the first of a cloud of arrows sped into the confident Imperials. Gord's eye followed the path of the missile he had released and saw his target go down as the stone struck him full on the temple. Thrown into disarray by a missile attack they had not anticipated, the remainder of the foot soldiers were easy prey for the men they had been preparing to kill. The captain signaled to the members of Gord's band to move ahead, and they advanced along with similar groups to the right and left, going slowly and using all the cover available. After a few score yards, they were halted again, for beyond there was less cover and fewer trees. In this partial clearing stood hundreds of the Overking's heavy infantry in blue and gold, forming an attack toward them. The woodsmen on the Imperial force's left flank came howling out of the forest. The disciplined formation turned to face this challenge, only to have its new flank assaulted by missiles from Gord's group and the others on the others on either side. The Overking's men fell back in confusion, heading for the river. But since there were some 200 bowmen, slingers, and javeliniers along their route of retreat, they were soon forced into an obliquing retrograde. "That's three of those bun-blasting Imperials I've nailed so far this round," shouted Chert from his post at Gord's side. Wren's voice from the rear back called back derisively, "Never mind counting the needlework. Our wager is your axe versus my little chopper here." Break. All right, now here we have this, you know, we've added Gord to this, and but still, we have Gygax's experience in wargaming and his interest in historical war fighting, and so he gives a good description of what would happen to these, you know, these Imperial troops in the forest there. They really can't get a break because either they're fighting a melee in a bad terrain inside the woods, or they break into an area where it's open, and they can do their formation and shift so that they are protecting their flank. But the archers are cutting them down, and when they moved to protect their flank, they're really offering their backs, where they don't have, some of them don't have the chest plates, to the archers to hit them from the side or behind.
What is an obliquing retrograde? Do you know?
What he's talking about is they formed a line. Now, when these men march, they march normally in column, which means they're along. They match the roadway, so that instead of a line where the men are just very broadly put out in this wide formation, they're forced to the width of the road, which may be only 10, 15 men wide. So as they approached across the shallows, they formed out more and walked into the woods. Now, part of them discovered this area where there's an opening in the woods, enough for several hundred men. And when they hit that, they form again. So they're back, and this group is in line then, facing probably to the west, because they're advancing in that direction. So when they need to retreat, they're being shredded by the attacks on the front and the flank, and so what they have to do is they have to go back into a column, which would be I believe that's what it means, is that they're back into a column, and they've been forced forced to close the width of their retreating line. So instead of a line that might be, 50 or more men with some ranks behind them, they go back into a more narrow column as they're trying to protect their one flank and move at a greater pace. And that's what I would say that the retrograde is the description of the collapsing line back into a column. And obliquing would mean that it is completely off angle from the original direction they were facing. So, because they're trying to retreat back to the east, so they may be, you know, at a sharp angle facing northeast, southeast, or they may be mostly just facing the east and trying to retreat. And that, you know, that really... also, since their movement is in that direction, it really destroys that line, long line formation that they're so successful at in you know, fighting against, especially melee-armed people. Just within that clearing, if it weren't for that clearing, they would still be a scattered, broken formation.
So the archers are really negating their advantage. Right, because their advantage is to be fully formed and in formation, and forcing them into a column restricts it, it's better for them defensively, but it's offensively it minimizes their effect.
Yes, and while they want to go in one direction, it makes it very hard to have any kind of protection against their rear and their flank. Because normally with these pole arms, they're, you know, it's they're going to have to raise them if they're on a retreat, because they don't want to point the pole arms at the backs of their own people. So yeah, that obliquing retrograde, I think it just follows the sound that they have to shift formation, they have to close formation from column to line, and that they also have to raise their weapons. Because they can't be, you know, moving with the space needed to keep the people in front of them, you know. And also, when you're moving, it's very difficult to hold those pikes, you know, outward. Much easier to raise them a little or shoulder them. So, yeah, you know, I think that is a description of the line coming apart under the flanking attack, the arrows. From the archers after they had tried to protect their one side.
All right. Well, thank you for that explanation.
Oh yeah. I'm a war gamer myself, but it's been a while, and it went my historical war gaming and reading, and I'm no expert like Gygax was. All right. I'm going to restart. It is...
There's one more thing I noticed.
Okay.
It seemed like a little Tolkien-esque, right? When they're like saying how many they got and they got a bet.
I know. I found that a little painful. I mean, yeah. I believe that...
got done saying how good he was doing.
It was getting to me a little Helm's Deep there, you know.
Right.
You know, like there's some... you know, Gygax was using a lot of things to add that he wanted to spice it up, and things that he knew was good. And maybe, you know, while he was writing this, it just did not, some of the Tolkienisms and Lieberisms, that he didn't really catch them, that this was, you know, stuff that popped out. And I really don't think had a good editor, or an editor willing to go up against Gygax and say, well, you know, this isn't very good, this is very Tolkien, this is very Lieber. I just think that unless it was really knocking the guy on the head, he probably had a very, very laissez-faire edit of this book. Or, you know, an edit that would correct, say, grammar and syntax, but I don't think too many criticism of the storyline itself. Perhaps some comment on confusion, because there's a lot of intricate things happening, not just here, but throughout the story, and some of it is geographic. When Gord was coming toward Nurl for the first time, the map we were reviewing was based on earlier map, and it not, you know, there were some name changes because Sargent changed names from the books, but there also was a confusion about, I think, the direction Gord was taking. So, it threw off things from the map. And right here, this is the Battle of Woodsford. And looking at the, Anna's map, it really seems like it should be where Angleford is. And Angleford and... Fosh Crossing.
They got there in the Tesser.
Yes, and so on the Harp, I mean, Woodsford is definitely on the Harp, but mm-hmm. I think if you look at the map, you need to do a few replacements to bring it in line with the Gygax story. Now, some people, I'm a very Gygaxian person, so I really put more influence on what Gygax said than what later people came in and wanted to change. So some things that maybe changes by like Sargent and stuff, naming and geographic position. If I see Gygax say it, that's what it is. And right. Then later on, if Sargent wants to change it, that is kind of, an individual choice. The Sargent became the Swerk, became the force behind the advancing timeline, and the continued setting material that came out was really using Sargent, not Gygax. And yet, these two books are TSR books, the first two. Right. It doesn't get to the third book that it's no longer part of TSR being produced by.
This is Gary's first novel, right?
Yes. Now, he did write others. He had a series, he had an adventure game come out later that was called
Dangerous Journeys. Yeah.
Yes. And he has two or three novels that are set in the Dangerous Journeys universe. And I found them to be, I was entertained by them. I have not read them as much as I've read this.
They're mysteries, aren't they? Or at least one of them is.
Yes, I believe the...
Because I know I read one. That's the one. Yeah,
Samarican Solution. There's at least one other, maybe two others. I don't remember if it's two or three of those novels. But, and I thought that they were written well after this, and I thought his writing had improved quite a bit.
I mean, I heard that it's difficult to get him to change anything. Like, I heard, people... who might have wanted to edit him found that difficult.
Yeah, and he was the boss, and right. He was a talented man, I'm not a good businessman, but which to me is no insult, but a wonderful creator, and he was a decent writer for this narrative fiction. And then what he did with the setting material, he really crafted some wonderful stuff, some interesting adventures. He was a real craft. He crafted some beautiful work. He was, a little like Mozart there. He could do some things very, very well. I can understand why it would be very intimidating to try to edit somebody who was producing some incredible material here. I think lore and the descriptions of the actions and such that we can use for the game, for me, they still outweigh the narrative fiction and the characters. I find the settings so intriguing and so well put together and right to my taste. That this is what I like, this is what I enjoy, and it's not, I honestly say it's not for everyone, but I just find what Gygax actually produced creatively mostly to be, fantastic stuff.
Yeah, and for that reason alone, I mean, I would just accept Gary's opinion or place names, whatever he defined in the setting over people who came later, like Sargent.
And you know, Sargent, really, for me, things didn't really get back into a Gygaxian feel till the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer, which, you know, it's a setting book, so it's not, you know, it's not directly, and it covers the whole campaign because it's a restart. And I found that Eric Mona and Gary Hawley and Fred, those three really did, but they were fans, you know. They were diehard fans, and they made a big difference from the work for hire stuff that we see. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page 273, and the second paragraph. The order came to advance upon the struggling Imperials. Gord and his compatriots rushed across the open space and into the trees on the opposite side in hot pursuit, and soon close work demanded the tossing aside of bows in favor of axe, sword, and like arms. Now the full force of the big woods folk was falling on the soldiers of the Overking, and the infantry was being pushed back and crowded into a defensive position at the head of the ford. Then the Imperial horse, having finished their crossing, were among their own footmen, and in their desire to strike at the enemy, the cavalry were careless as to who they rode down. By the time they got through the lines of pole-armed soldiers and rode toward their adversaries, it was evident that the infantry brigade would not be fit to contest with another foe for some time to come. Break. All right, now this is something that, you know, it should be, I feel, a rule, and it's been a rule of thumb of mine in AD&D, is morale. And that is a big thing in wargaming, because normally troops do not fight to the death of their whole unit. What they do is break. At some point, either early, they have a low morale and they're easily broken, or they have a very high morale and take a lot of casualties before they run or retreat or hunker down in a defensive position. And their aggressiveness at some point ends, and either they stop or else they just turn tail and run. What can happen to the troops after that is that, having taken too many casualties, the troops become very demoralized, and they cannot be reformed right away, so that even if your force is not dead, it is either scattered, which I'd imagine most of this polearm force would be, or they've taken so many casualties that you can't get the men at this point to really do any fighting again. They just want to get out of there, when you try to reform them, it takes more to gather up to reform troops that have had a lot of casualties, because they're trained in these, even if they're part of a big, big formation, you're trained with certain of people who are with you all the time. And like it's mentioned that the front rank troops have that chest plate, that would put them at the elite of the elite, you know, because they're in the most dangerous position and they're getting better armor. And say, once a number of them are killed, then that group, you know, is very demoralized. They used to punish troops by decimating them, and that was killing one man in 10. And that was, that would usually break of formation. It's just the loss of 10%. And yet these men have probably lost, you know, 20, 30, 50% of their people. And now they've had their own allied troops, the cavalry, ride them down.
Yeah, it sounds like the Imperial cavalry is riding down the Imperial infantry.
And that is a common occurrence, especially when you have a force of nobles who are in that cavalry. Is a very, they're, I believe, the guard, the Overking's guard. That has happened many a time in history, where at a certain stage where the cavalry was a main attacking force rather than like scouting troops, that they'd want to get to battle and they would just ride over their own troops so that they could get into battle. So yeah, that this is a big historical occurrence that has happened, where, and exactly with the same result, that those troops that they've now ridden down, they break and become really a retreating, useless group of men for that battle. All right. Where was I? I'm sorry.
Paragraph 273.
Ah, all right, exactly. All right. Third? Third paragraph.
Yeah.
All right. That's right, I see it. All right. Gord was close enough to the river now to see some of the displays of magic that marked where the spellcasters of the opposing forces were trying to gain an advantage for their own side. A horrible-looking thing, seemingly formed from the very waters of the harp, rose up suddenly and was rushing toward the rear of the long line of horsemen. But it suddenly seemed to lose speed and sag, then rippled into nothingness. Little darts of glowing coral color leapt from the far shore to strike and slay any woodsman who showed a target. A great cloud of ghastly citrine hue formed in a place above the river where no Imperials were fighting, and it quickly traveled westward with a rolling, sickening movement. It touched the tree line, and Gord heard screams and coughing cries. Then it was blown downstream by some gust of wind, and the Imperial horse recoiled from its edge. Then came great claps of thunderous noise, and streaks of lightning and explosive flashes of fire were flying back and forth, slaying friend and foe so indiscriminately that the process were soon stopped. The Imperial cavalry regrouped and came on again. Then the sky, which had grown darker and cloudier by slow degrees, began to release a cold, fine rain. "Shit, there goes the bows," grumbled Chirk. "Now it's time for our contest," laughed Wren in reply to his remark. All right, I really thought that was, very interesting and revealing use of magic here, because Gygax incorporated the very names of the spells into the description of them and their use. We have obviously magic missiles with that coral-covered bolts of light. We have an elemental forming. We have a stinking cloud, or even a worse kind of noxious cloud coming upon the troops and then blown away by a gust of wind. And so we're seeing druidic magic being used against various forms of mostly straight magical, magician magic. And I thought that was a very, well done showing of battle magic going on, and what you can look for when these, powerful spells, especially the ones that are good against a mass, are being used in a battle rather than in single combat or combat against a very small force. Here we're seeing what spells and how they're described to be used against mass formations. And cloud spells are particularly handy that can drift over a large body. And in the original rules, the fireball, if used outside, is a very, can be a very large, or come over a very large area. Lightning is following a long path, so it can bounce from soldier to soldier to soldier, and just fighting against common soldiers can just bring them down in droves. Especially like chain lightning.
Yeah, I killed a whole bunch this Sunday with a lightning bolt.
Yes. Yes, and if you can get it to reflect, to bounce back, it's, even more ferocious. And not that high-level spell. It's one of the most effective, aggressive spells out there.
Yeah, that and Fireball are third level.
Yeah, so they're very, very handy at a very low level. It can, relatively. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page number 274 and the first paragraph. "Stay out of the way of those crazy magicians," was all that Gord could add as he readied for the horsemen to ride them down. As the lances lowered and the destriers began to move forward at a trot, the heavens were torn by jagged strokes of lightning. These bolts streaked down amidst enemy knights and their attendant riders, making metal glow and crackle, bringing down men and steeds in smoking ruins. In reply, a whirlwind suddenly swooped down out of the lowering sky and tore into the ranks of the waiting woodsfolk. The cavalry charged ahead to escape the crackling electricity, and their adversaries ran to meet them rather than face the roaring destruction of the tornado that was shredding trees and men alike. Once Mealy was joined, the dreadful destruction of the deadly Deomer ceased, for bloody work was now the sole purview of fighter and ranger, barbarian and cavalier. Break. All right. Now, see, now we have, this I believe is the first mention of ranger. I really suspect that this force of woodsfolk really is combined of the two elements, the ones like Ren and Chert, who are barbarians by class, by, you know, gaming class, and then the others, I think, like Stalker these others who are rangers. And they were probably most of what they're referring to as the rangers are probably mostly the bowmen. And then we have the general fighters of the Overking and the cavaliers. So that knightly class of the Imperial Horse Guard here, they are, I think, being described as cavaliers, which, you know, is they're not paladins, and they're not just armored fighters. They're actually a specialist character class within the AD&D setting. I think they came out, they probably either unearthed Arcana or Dragon Magazine for the Cavalier class. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 274 and paragraph 4. "The rain went from drizzle to downpour, augmented by sudden bursts of great blinding raindrops. These conditions prevented the Imperial horsemen from making a slaughter of their unmounted foes. Nevertheless, their lances and greatswords took a heavy toll on the brave defenders. Gord fought silently and kept near Chert, who was now nearly berserk, swinging his broad axe with both hands, and so powerfully as to sunder steel and flesh in a single stroke. In turn, Chert stayed near the Amazonian female, who commanded their squad, a unit that now numbered only 4. The ground underfoot became a mire of mud, blood, and bodies. There were screams and howls mixed with banging and clashing, a cacophony that numbed the mind as much as the weapon work deadened the soul. Gord lost count of how many men he had met. Some were before him one moment, and after stroke and counter, were swept away in the press of milling, shouting, struggling humanity. Others remained long enough to thrust or cut and parry until Gord slew them. In the process, he had taken many wounds himself, but none were serious. His greatest enemy now was the growing fatigue brought by exertion and tension of battle. How long could this awful melee continue? Until one side or the other was dead, or broke and fled. Either way, he must fight on." So, originally, they were about a group of 10, and so 6 of them are dead, and they're just down to Ren, Chert, Gord, and an unnamed character. But, you know, this is just 10 out of, you know, thousands that are in Stalker's, you know, brigade right there. That we have some, you know, interesting that they would, they've forced these men out from their cover, so that's why the mounted horse can do much greater damage. That was actually, that whirlwind was, you know, a very potent spell to be used against them. because the loss of staying in that heavy woodlands really increases the damage from the mounted soldiers who are fighting probably in the shallows of the fort at this point. As in the story, they've jumped a little back with Helm's Deep, but at least they're not calling out the numbers that they've killed. And there may be in the editing there was some commentary about that this was a little too Tolkien-esque. But now we're on the point where there's two things that are happening. Again, they're breaking some of the units of the Overking, and they're retreating. And that is morale. And what I do in my own campaign is I have morale for the monsters, for the opponents of the player characters, while the player characters are heroes, and they are immune or have very, very great morale. In some war games, what they have is they have like one counter or one miniature representing 6 to 10 men as a squad. And what will happen is under certain conditions, that group of regular soldiers can spawn off somebody who is heroic and becomes his morale shoots up. He increases the morale of people around him. So what I normally do is I have morale, but mostly so that it gives an opportunity for every encounter with a group of foes, or even individual foes, not to become a slaughter, that there's a point where that monster, and some monsters should have very good morale, but it comes a point where the orcs, the goblins, the hobgoblins, even trolls and ogres and stuff, that they take so much loss around them, there's so much threat, that they run for it. Now, the second thing that is brought up is fatigue. And that is something I can't remember if that fatigue rolls ever made it into any of the rule books. But, you know, in combat, combat goes on for, you know, a surprising amount of time. And what can happen is your troops just simply, they reach a point of exhaustion. At that point, that's really where the battles can end inconclusively, because both sides haven't made enough of, both sides are still willing to fight, but both sides have been fighting so long that they're tired out. That's why one of the tactics was to have a reserve. And, you know, you'd wonder why you wouldn't use all your men, because what you would want is when you reach the point where the enemy troops are exhausted, or your own troops are becoming ineffectual because of exhaustion and morale, you send in these fresh troops who have done nothing up to that point. And so they have a huge advantage over troops that are fatigued and lowered morale. We've had a number of breaks and we're still not through this battle. So for basically 2 hours, we have been discussing and reading this battle. We're just about out of time here, so I'm going to stop at this point before moving any forward. I think it's a decent stopping point, because here we have where the Gord is talking about being fatigued. We're talking about breaking, the Imperial troops breaking, and the confusion now from the rain and everything. So I am going to stop here on page number 274, the second paragraph from the end. It is just about 7 o'clock, but I think I'm going to summon up Craig here and end it for the night. Let me just call on our recording bot, Craig, and I misspelled that, and it is July 16th, 2021, and that is the end of recording number 36. Well, good night.
Good night.